dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A new presidential administration is about to be imposed. It began with a stolen election and is likely to proceed like a gang rape, with ourselves and our environment as the victims, unless we fight back. Now that G.W. Bush's cabinet has been made visible, it is clear that American might will be brought to bear on behalf of certain special interests, the oil industry chief among them. One of their special targets is the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, which they hope to turn into an oil field. First in the program tonight, a documentary on that special place now under threat. Then we'll look at another devastating project that will be sure to get lots of attention. The Free Trade Area of the Americas, the extension of NAFTA's Profits Over People program to the entire Western Hemisphere.
The following program, Looted Plain, America's Serengeti, is a special presentation of Coyote Nation Press. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, commonly referred to as the ANWR, is located in the upper northeast corner of Alaska, inside the Arctic Circle. The refuge is the heart of a thriving Arctic ecosystem that hosts thousands of migratory birds, provides denning habitat for polar bears, and is the calving grounds for the 129,000 member Porcupine River caribou herd. Because of its wild and pristine nature, combined with an abundant array of wildlife found nowhere else on Earth, the Arctic Refuge has been referred to as the American Serengeti. In this half hour, we'll take a closer look at the issues surrounding the refuge and listen to the voices of those who are fighting to preserve our last wild place. In 1960, Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower, recognizing the unique value of this ecosystem, set aside 8 million acres of Arctic wilderness, thus establishing the refuge and ensuring its protection from future development. But tragically, some 1.5 million acres located on the coast, referred to as the coastal plain, were left unprotected from exploitation. It is this critical but vulnerable area that is now threatened by the oil industry, with help from their pawns in Congress and the White House. The coastal plain is the seasonal home and summer calving grounds of the Porcupine River caribou herd. The Gwich'in Indians, who inhabit this sparse land, depend upon the annual migration of the caribou to maintain their traditional way of life and culture. Experts say that these caribou migration routes will be in jeopardy if oil exploration and development is allowed within the wildlife refuge. The Gwich'in people and porcupine caribou have coexisted here for 1,000 generations since the Ice Age, some 200 centuries ago. The loss of this place will also be a loss of a rich cultural legacy, and it will be lost for the worst possible reason, the unbridled greed of a few. There is a chance of saving this remarkable place. Before he leaves office, President Clinton can declare the refuge a national monument, protecting it from destructive speculative interests. President-elect George W. Bush has expressed his determination to open the refuge to drilling.
Sensing the imminent dangers to this remarkable place, conservation activist Margaret Murray wrote in the 1950s, "My prayer is that Alaska will not lose the heart-nourishing friendliness of her youth, that her people will always care for one another, her towns remain friendly and not completely ruled by the dollar, and that her great wild places will remain great and wild and free, where wolf and caribou, wolverine and grizzly bear, and all the Arctic blossoms may live on in the delicate balance which supported them long before impetuous man appeared in the north. This is the great gift Alaska can give to the world."
Relentlessly the Arctic Sea resounds upon the shore, and Mugo's court the waves report just as 10,000 years before. And coming through the caribou, renew the ancient round. And as they do, a chosen few return their bodies to the ground. And it is tragic, it is pure. To survive is to endure, and all is just as it should be. The coastal plain, the Arctic Sea, and summers move on towards the call of distant lands, leaving only memories and cloven hoof prints in the sand. And the ocean glimmers gold tonight, bathed in Arctic light. Somewhere a tern takes rest from flight, somewhere a calf will die tonight. And it is tragic, it is pure, to survive is to endure, and all is just as it should be. The coastal plain, the Arctic Sea, and all is just as it should be.
The Caribou Commons Project is a unique collaboration of northern artists, Aboriginal people, and conservation groups fighting to protect the refuge. Coyote Nation's Alaska Yukon correspondent, Fiona Stewart Campbell, interviewed Ken Mattson, one of the project's contributors, during his recent speaking tour on behalf of the refuge.
I spoke with Ken while he was here in Haines, Alaska, to present his traveling multimedia slide presentation show, Images, Sounds, and Music of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This beautiful and moving show featured incredible photography of wildlife and scenery from the coastal plain of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and music composed by recording artist Matthew Lien and Wildlands. During the course of the presentation, Ken spoke at length about his 100-day, 1,000-mile journey by foot, kayak, and canoe from the Arctic Refuge to the Gwich'in village of Old Crow, Yukon. And he spoke movingly of personal encounters he himself had during that trek with the Gwich'in people, the caribou, and other members of the wildlife family.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your experiences on your trip? What were some of the moments that stand out in your mind and heart?
I remember one time toward the end of my trip where we were dragging our canoes up a river called the Rat River, and the last part of the trip was going to be paddling down the Porcupine River to the Gwich'in village of Old Crow in the Yukon Territory, and I met this 84-year-old woman living at a fish camp on her own, and the first thing she did was invite me to come in and have something to eat because it was a cold, wet day and I was, you know, tired. And without asking any questions, she brought me in and fed me and looked after me. And here she was, 84 years old, living out on her own. And we got talking, and I told her why I was there, what my purpose was. And she started laughing really uproariously, and I couldn't figure out what was so funny. And then finally she said, "You're working for me. You're working for me. Now we like you. Now we like you," she said, trying to feed me, whether or not she liked me. But there was this immediate, when I talked about the caribou, it was such a part of her growing up and her life, and still her subsistence needs and her family. You know, she wouldn't be able to survive without that. And so to meet me out there working to help protect it was just created this bond, and it was one of the moments on the trip that I really remember.
Fully 90% of the coastal plain in an area called the North Slope is already open for oil development, yet the oil industry wants to open up the last 10%. They claim that current reserves in the fields at Prudhoe Bay are running dry and will be unable to produce enough oil to keep the Trans-Alaska pipeline open. It's important to note that 85% of Alaska's state budget comes from oil royalties. In fact, each Alaskan receives a check every year for more than $1,000 just for living in the state. Rumors of declining oil production make for effective propaganda by the oil industry. Conversely, asking Americans to consume less energy is slightly less appealing than giving away free money. Prudhoe Bay is the best-known example of the oil industry's plundering of the North Slope's fragile environment. Toxic pools and oil spills abound. The pipeline itself and the infrastructure which supports the oil industry workers illustrate the worst effects of modern extraction technology. By their own example, the oil industry has shown that there is no clean method of extracting oil from this pristine landscape. According to author Paul Hawken, over 90% of the storage pits in Prudhoe Bay violate EPA regulations for toxins, heavy metals, and carcinogenic contaminants. More than 23,000 oil spills have occurred since exploration began here. This is the same technology that would be used inside the refuge. 90% of Alaska's Arctic is already eligible for oil exploration. The Sierra Club says that oil operations in the Arctic annually emit over 43,000 tons of oxides of nitrogen, more than double emitted from Washington, D.C. There are hundreds of oil spills each year on the North Slope involving tens of thousands of gallons of crude oil and other petroleum products. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation lists over 60 contaminated sites associated with North Slope oil industry operations. Yet the oil industry continues to apply enormous political pressure to exploit this wilderness. During the height of the Gulf conflict, Republicans were thwarted when legislation they introduced to open up the refuge was defeated. A Bush presidency combined with a Republican Congress spells disaster for the refuge unless it is protected now. Some may argue that opening up the refuge would create jobs. But a study done by the Telus Institute in Boston in 1993 clearly illustrates how employing conservation techniques can create many times more jobs while saving energy. Our biggest reserves of oil are in conservation, And conservation doesn't kill caribou, endanger Aboriginal peoples, or threaten entire ecosystems with toxic contamination. Hawken also notes, the fact is that ceiling insulation and double-glazed windows can produce more oil than the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge at its most optimistic projections, at about 1/20th the cost, with 4 times the employment. Given the oil industry's record and the benefits of conservation, there is simply no valid reason for opening up the last of our wild and pristine places, for oil, for money, for anything. Once again, Fiona Stewart-Campbell with Ken Madsen.
The Arctic Coastal Plain, the Arctic Refuge, is the most important onshore denning site for polar bears in the United States. Female polar bears have been known to abandon their maternity dens when seismic oil activity is going on, so they are also vulnerable. And one thing that, when we've been traveling around, that many people can identify with are the migratory birds. It's just an incredible, you know, birthplace for migratory birds. They come from all over. They come from 4 different continents. They come from every state in the United States, and they travel to the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge to nest, and more than 100 species of birds go out to the coastal plain. And so people from wherever, doesn't matter where they are, if they're in New Jersey or Florida, some of the birds that they see passing through their state go to the special place to have, you know, to have their chicks every year. And so it's just an incredible, you know, birthing area. And then, of course, there's the life in the ocean, the bowhead whales, which is an endangered species, and belugas, and 3 species of seals, and you know, musk oxen on the coastal plain, as well as Arctic foxes and wolves. And it's just a incredible, intact predator prey ecosystem, which is a very rare thing on Earth these days.
Yes, it is. And especially given the example of the migratory birds, it's important for people to realize that, who live in the lower 48, to realize that the Anwar is not an isolated place, but that in many respects, each of us is linked to America's Serengeti.
That's
the
right,
birds
yes.
being an example.
You know, the actions that you take in your own home will affect this place way off in the Arctic, and vice versa. If we allow oil development there, it will affect our own homes and our backyards and what happens where we live. And that that connection, I think, is a really strong thing. And once people make that connection, I think they can apply it to many other areas besides just the Arctic Refuge.
From Haines, Alaska, I'm Fiona Stewart-Campbell.
The list of would-be despoilers of the Arctic Refuge is long. Let's round up the usual suspects. Suspect number 1, President-elect George W. Bush. This ex-oil man has received nearly $2.7 million from the oil and gas industry for his presidential campaign. In comparison, Al Gore received $291,000, a little more than 10% of what Bush was given. Ralph Nader received a whopping $1,100, less than one-half of 1% of what Bush pulled in. Alaska's 2 pro-development senators, Frank Murkowski and Ted Stevens, received a combined total of about $1.5 million from the oil and gas industry in the last election cycle. Murkowski is chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and an outspoken opponent of wilderness. He is a perennial sponsor of legislation to open the refuge for oil drilling. Stevens is chairman of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee and has been working to open the refuge since 1980. And the list of perpetrators goes on and on.
You
Norma Cassie is a spokeswoman for the Gwich'in people. The following is an excerpt from the Caribou Commons Project CD.
This is the land of the Gwich'in. We have our language and a strong culture based on the land. This land that we live in is critical not only for our needs, it's also a critical habitat for dozens of animals and many migratory birds. One time, years and years ago, when I was probably about 10 years old, my grandpa and I were out walking around the shores of all these lakes in Old Crow Flats, and we stopped by this one to make fire and have some tea and bannock, and we're sitting there and we're eating, and it was really quiet, and we're watching some loons playing out there on the lake, and grandpa told me, he said that sometime in the future, probably pretty close to the time you become a mom, there's going to be very few animals or birds out there on this lake swimming around. And when the loons, when you see just the loon out there, then that means that the earth, our environment here is in trouble. And now when I go back to the flats and I go back to that same spot, I see one loon, maybe two loons out there. And I often think about that and I remember that. Aboriginal people have been a part of this cycle of life in the north for tens of thousands of years. The Gwich'in are subsistence people. We don't need to consume more and more to fuel our culture. The Gwich'in people are caribou people. We call ourselves that, and that has come from way, way back because we have taken care of this herd for thousands and thousands of years. What is very sacred about our lands, too, we live near the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou, and during times of famine amongst our people, and they travel all those areas up there in the Arctic and share food with each other. But during times of famine, we never, ever go near the calving grounds. It is a very sacred area. Even the wolves and the bears protect the time of calving, and they don't go there as much either. And what is very well known right now all over the world is that we have many threats to the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou, this particular area that we hold so sacred. We have threats from oil and gas development. We also have threats of influx of people and too much air activity in those areas. The major one, of course, is the oil and gas development. Oil and gas, which they say, you know, is a 200-day supply for the United States. And if they were to open up the Arctic refuge, it would be to me and to my people like going into a hospital nursery and tearing that apart. That's how we feel about it. We will do everything that we can and everything in our power to stop that because it means our life. Large tracts of land must be preserved in these areas to ensure the survival of our animals, not only in the Yukon, but our neighboring areas as well. Aboriginal people offer the world an alternative to a culture of consumption. If we ravage the land, we will follow a path that will destroy the wildlife in our ancient culture. A lot of stuff that I share with people is not my own stuff. It is stuff that I have learned along the way in my life and that are given to me by the old people. And one of the things that stand out in my mind so strongly now, in this time when we are having so much trouble with the way we treat our animals and the land around us, he said, listen for the howl of the spiritual brother, the wolf. For how it goes with him, it goes with the natural world.
finally, in the words of Robert Marshall, founder of the Wilderness Society, there is just one hope of repulsing the tyrannical ambition of civilization to conquer every niche on the whole earth. That hope is the organization of spirited people who will fight for the freedom of the wilderness.
Fruited Plain, America's Serengeti, was written by Fiona Stewart Campbell and Bill McLaughlin. Our program was produced by Bill McLaughlin at the studios of WNTI in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Original music was by Wildlands with Matthew Lien from the Caribou Commons Project CD and by Kate and Paul from their Earth Amber CD on Buy or Die Records. Our theme music was written and performed by Brian Carroll. To find out how you can help save the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, call the Alaska Wilderness League at 1-800-322-5205. Information on the Caribou Commons Project can be found at their website, cariboucommons.com. If you missed any portion of this program or would like to hear it again, an audio archive can be found at our website, coyotenation.org. This has been a production of Coyote Nation Press, which is solely responsible for its content. I'm June Benaise. Thank you for listening.
Senator Charles Schumer, supposedly representing us, has gone on record favoring drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. You can contact him to tell him that you want the Arctic preserved and that he should be pursuing sustainable, non-polluting energy development. You can reach him on the web through www.senate.gov, G-O-V, and use the pull-down menu for the state of New York. Or you can call him at his Syracuse office at area code 315-423-5471. What is the Free Trade Area of the Americas, known as the FTAA for short? It's the formal name given to an expansion of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that would include nearly all of the countries in the Western Hemisphere. This massive NAFTA expansion is currently being negotiated in secret by trade ministers from a total of 34 nations in North, Central, South America, and the Caribbean. The goal of the FTAA is to impose the failed NAFTA model of increased privatization and deregulation hemisphere-wide. Imposition of these rules would empower corporations to constrain governments from setting standards for public health and safety, to safeguard their workers, and to ensure corporations do not pollute the communities in which they operate. Effectively, these rules would handcuff governments' public interest policymaking and enhance corporate control at the expense of citizens throughout the Americas. The FTAA would deepen the negative effects of NAFTA that we've seen in Canada, Mexico, and the United States over the past 7 years, and expand NAFTA's damage to the other 31 countries involved. The FTAA would intensify NAFTA's race to the bottom. Under FTAA, exploited workers in Mexico could be leveraged against even more desperate workers in Haiti, Guatemala, or Brazil by companies seeking tariff-free access back into U.S. markets. A quick look at NAFTA's legacy reveals disastrous consequences. It's estimated that over 1 million U.S. jobs have been lost since NAFTA, as companies are relocated to Mexico to take advantage of the weaker labor standards. Workers displaced by this job exportation usually find jobs with less security and wages that are about 77% of what they originally had, something we're extremely familiar with here in the Finger Lakes region. Despite promises of increased economic development throughout Mexico, only the border region has seen intensified industrial activity. Yet even this small so-called gain has not brought prosperity. Over 1 million more Mexicans work for less than the minimum wage of $3.40 per day today than before NAFTA. And during the NAFTA period, 8 million Mexicans have fallen from the middle class into poverty. In addition, the increase of border industry has created worsening environmental and public health threats in the area. Along the border, the occurrence of some diseases, including hepatitis, is 2 to 3 times the national average, due to lack of sewage treatment and safe drinking water. Although it's hard to imagine that anyone would push for more of a failed model like this, what little we do know about FTAA is that it is likely to look quite a bit like NAFTA. In fact, some FTAA texts are reported to be literally based on NAFTA, with additional countries added in. What will the FTAA's practical effects be? Because negotiations are occurring in secret and no texts have been made publicly available, we cannot know the details of the draft text. However, conversations between NGOs and the U.S. Trade Representative have given us some clues about what to expect once a final agreement is unveiled. In other words, once it's too late to change it. Essential social services will be endangered. The FTAA will contain a series of commitments to, quote, liberalize services, which is much like the General Agreement on Trade in Services, GATS, within the WTO. Services is a broad category that includes education, health care, environmental services, which can include access to water, energy, postal services, and anything else we pay for that isn't a physical object. Possible effects of the FTAA services agreement include removal of national licensing standards for medical, legal, and other key professionals, allowing doctors licensed in one country to practice in any country, even if their level of training or technological sophistication is different. Privatization of public schools and prisons in the United States, opening the door to greater corporate control, corruption, and the temptation to cut critical corners, such as medical care for inmates or upkeep of safe school facilities, in the interests of improving profit margins. And privatization of postal services, transferring U.S. Postal Service functions to a few delivery companies like FedEx, which could then send postal rates through the roof. Like in NAFTA's Chapter 11, the U.S. Trade Representative says that the FTAA will include investor-to-state suits. These allow corporations to sue governments directly for the removal of standards or laws designed to protect public health and safety, which may cost the corporations a little more in operating costs. In other words, the FTAA would provide a hemispheric regulatory takings clause that explicitly values corporate profits over human costs. The FTAA will also affect our food and agriculture. The U.S. is trying to force all countries to accept biotechnology and genetically modified foods, in which unregulated U.S.-based corporations have taken a lead. Yet food security organizations all over the world agree that these technologies will increase hunger in poor nations. Being forced to buy expensive patented seeds every season, rather than saving and planting their own, will force traditional subsistence farmers in the developing world into dependency on transnational corporations and closer to the brink of starvation. If the U.S. position wins out, FTAA will promote the interests of biotech and agribusiness giants like Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, and Monsanto over the interests of hungry people in developing nations. The U.S. is also trying to expand NAFTA's corporate protectionism rules on patents to the whole hemisphere. These rules give a company with a patent in one country the monopoly marketing rights to the item throughout the region. These rules are enforced with cash fines and criminal penalties, making these rules even harsher than the present WTO intellectual property rules. This monopoly control allows pharmaceutical corporations to keep drug prices high and block production of generic versions of life-saving drugs, which spells disaster for the ill and impoverished, especially in developing nations. These rules also allow companies to bioprospect and lock down patents for traditional medicines that are considered traditional knowledge, effectively robbing indigenous people of their cultural heritage in order to fatten their corporate wallets. The next ministerial-level summit meeting to negotiate the free trade of the Americas is planned for Quebec City, Canada, April 18th through 22nd, 2001, that is next April, at which negotiators will start building the whole text. They hope to have the agreement complete and implemented in 2005. Massive street protests have been called in Quebec City in opposition to the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. A teach-in on the FTAA was held recently in Vancouver, British Columbia. Tonight we're going to hear from several of the panelists. The first speaker is Ellen Gould from the International Forum on Globalization. The International Forum on Globalization is an alliance of 60 leading activists, scholars, economists, researchers, and writers that was formed in 1994 to stimulate new thinking, joint activity, and public education in response to economic globalization.
I was recently in a consultation meeting with the Canadian ambassador to Guatemala, and some of you in the room were there with me and witnessed me losing it, which is a regular occurrence when I get around foreign affairs and international trade these days. But the guy who had actually worked for a very long time for a development agency, so he should have known better, he said, "Why would I pay $30 for a shirt made in the East End of Montreal when I can buy one for $22 made in Central America?" Okay? So these are our fearless leaders who are doing the negotiating. Do people in the audience have a response to that? Why would you pay $30 for a shirt made in Canada rather than one made $8 cheaper? What if the workers in Central America were being treated really badly or underpaid? Or what if the process that they were using to make the shirts employed really rotten environmental conditions? Or what if, or what if? There's a lot of things you could have said in response to this guy. But this is an absolute with Canadian foreign affairs officials, that if it's cheaper for the consumer than it is given from on high, this is like gospel from on high. It's got to be better. So that's the fundamental underlying principle to all of these agreements, all of these letters that we're going to throw at you, FTAA, WTO, GATS. There's a fundamental principle here that they'll always argue that it's better for the consumer. Unfortunately, most of the rules that they're making up are actually going to increase the things that cost you money on an everyday basis. Your water is going to cost more, your electricity is going to cost more, things that you can't get away from. Like, you can kind of stop buying stuff at the Gap or whatever if it gets too expensive. But you can't stop buying food, and you can't stop using electricity, and you can't stop using water. And so this is an effort to capture what they call capturing the market. You're the market, okay? And make sure you pay. So that any way that societies have traditionally self-organized, like the people in this room getting together to organize your electrical delivery. This is how all this stuff originally started, so that people, ordinary working people, would have electricity They're getting in the way of that, and they're getting in the way of that in very, very concrete, specific ways. One of the neat things, if all this stuff sounds to you like the dog on The Simpsons barking because you hear national treatment and performance requirements and all that kind of stuff, once you get a handle on one agreement, you understand them all because it's the same principles working again and again and again. I'm working on the WTO agreement on services. Today, we got the Canadian position on the FTAA. So it was a bit of a mad scramble to try and dissect it for people and see what was actually in it. But really, once you get a handle on the basic principles, everything else just flows really easily. So I'd recommend just at some point, if you haven't already done it, get under your belt about five basic concepts and then you're off and running. One of the results that they found, and all the statistics are in on this stuff, it's absolutely indisputable at this point. Globalization done in this way produces inequality. And if your lives are getting really tough, if you've got two jobs and are trying to get a degree in something you hate just because you might potentially get a market skill, I don't know how many people in this room that applies to, but that's been my experience with a lot of young people. That's their lives. That's their day-to-day lives. The conditions that you're facing are not accidental and they're structured, okay? And you can change that structure, and hopefully that's what people will be committed to doing by going to Quebec City and taking these people on. So you've got all the statistics that show in every single place they've done an analysis, Latin America, Britain, Canada, that you get inequality out of these agreements. The preamble to the free trade area of the Americas that Canada is putting forward, it's on their website. Is everybody in this room kind of internet savvy? Because that's where all the information is. You can go to the website, you can read the preamble. It sounds wonderful. It sounds exactly what all of us would like. All of the preambles sound wonderful and like what everyone would like. They all have the legal enforceability of a Hallmark greeting card. They have no legal enforceability whatsoever. So it's just a bunch of words at the beginning. And then you have to get into the real stuff of the agreement. And that's kind of tough because it isn't written in a way that the average bear is going to understand. But in BC, we have a wealth of people who can help you dissect this and understand. When we say these agreements are anti-democratic, exactly what do we mean? When we say that they promote privatization, how do they do that? Not just in using rhetoric, but getting down to the nitty-gritty of what there is in all of these agreements that push us in the same direction. And you're going to get it through the Agreement on Internal Trade, you're going to get it through the FTA, you're going to get it through the WTO, unless you stop it. And they all have the same direction, which is to take more money out of your pocket and actually make sure that you earn less money. So they drive down wages, and that's all demonstrable. All the facts are available on this. Can't do it in 15 minutes. We can provide you with all that information. There's a number of really excellent books that have come out. MacArthur from the States has produced a book called Selling Free Trade. It's excellent. It shows what's happened in the U.S. and in Mexico to Mexican and American workers under free trade, under the free trade regime. And in Mexico, since 1997, the number of people living in extreme poverty, and by extreme they mean less than $2 a day, has grown by 4 million. That's twice as fast as the growth in the population. There's been an absolute phenomenal increase in the number of billionaires in Mexico. And how does this work play out in terms of the specifics of the agreement? Because my big thing is always get past the rhetoric so that people don't think you're just one of these anti-trade people, which is not what we're about. We're not anti-trade. We're in favor of fair trade. What recently happened through a NAFTA ruling was that Mexican trucks can now come freely across the border into the States because Mexico challenged American regulations, which prohibited the entry of of Mexican trucks. So that now there's 5 million Mexican trucks crossing the border. Fewer than 1% are ever inspected. Mexican drivers are virtually unregulated. They're corporations that basically own them, that hire them, make them work longer than 10 hours a day. And there's limitations, and this is not a great regulation, by the way. We've got drivers on the road in North America, and the limit is only 10 hours before they have to take a break. And that's being eroded by allowing Mexican drivers in under these very, very terrible labor laws. So we're not against Mexican workers. We're not against Mexican workers having jobs. But what happens to truck drivers in North America who are trying to make what is a reasonable living and not kill themselves? A lot of truck drivers are dying on the roads these days because of rotten labor conditions, rotten labor laws. So you've got the problem with wages being driven down, because what's going to be the response by American trucking companies? They're going to turn around and say, well, we can hire right out of Mexico. Why are we going to hire you guys at Teamster rates? And why, if you're bucking at working longer than a 10-hour day, are we going to keep you on? So this is the real, in real specific terms, how this stuff plays out. The other thing, of course, is that Mexican trucks do not have to meet any kind of environmental standards for pollution, and American trucks do. So that's how, in specific terms, NAFTA will be working to lower environmental standards and lower the everyday experience of truckers working in North America. So you read the preamble to the FTAA, and go there just for your own amusement. It starts off by saying that this agreement is about protecting the environment and promoting sustainable development by adopting trade and environmental policies that are mutually supportive. And that, you know, every time you read one of these things, you can just put a knot on the end, because that is their real effects in the real world. And all of that is easy to document. Acknowledging the importance of regulatory reform to advancing trade liberalization, increasing market openness, and enhancing competition within the hemisphere. All of these agreements act to actually concentrate corporate control. They do not increase competition. When you deregulate your energy market, you end up with Enron Corporation. Controlling, manipulating, spiking prices. California right now, as we speak, is facing a blackout because the major corporations have gone in there and played with the rules, which are supposed to be pro-competitive rules. They see you coming a mile off and they manipulate them. Has real effects in the real world. People in California now are facing blackouts. People who are on fixed incomes are opening their energy bills, and they're tied to contracts that triple the price. So where they say they're increasing competition, you actually get the opposite effects. You get concentration. And this might not happen immediately. The immediate effect might be a free-for-all and lots of competition, but ultimately you're allowing the big to swallow the smaller. 5 minutes. Okay. and you see there's amusing stuff while you're reading this. They've got some kind of new regulation that they're going to implement through the FTA, saying the following goods shall be considered as wholly obtained in the territory of one or more of the parties. Goods taken from outer space, provided they are obtained by a party or a person of a party and not processed in a non-party. And this is this is why you need help reading this stuff. So it can be absolutely a huge barrier to understanding, like, how is this going to affect me? But there's the CCPA, there's lots of people in BC who can help you wade through this stuff and figure out what it means and how you're going to be able to explain it over coffee to your friends, why you're so cranked up about it, why you're going to Quebec City. John Ralston Saul, when I was reading this stuff about goods from outer space provided by a non-party, whatever that is, he said that the sign of a sick civilization is the growth of an obscure, closed language that seeks to prevent communication. Well, here we have it with Trade Talk. I mean, it's quite amazing. They're also looking at the total elimination of tariffs for all inter-hemispheric trade within 10 years. And those of you who know about the environmental scene, who know about raw log exports, basically this accelerates what happens to resource-dependent economies like BC's, that you don't have tariffs in place so that you can try and process, add value within your region. Okay, so the raw exports just fly out with no ability to guarantee that the people of the community actually benefit from the development of the resources in the community. So the people in the community do not have a long-term interest in the preservation of those resources. And that's where the rubber hits the road in terms of the environment. The other thing that I picked up from reading through this stuff is that Canada is now going to go after all government purchasing and make sure that it's liberalized, it's deregulated, so that any purchasing done by any entity, which includes a university, okay? So if your university decides that you're going to purchase like environmentally friendly paper or you're going to hire locals to do whatever, you're going to be prohibited from doing that under these new initiatives they're making. 2 minutes. Okay. Okay. They just say that that's a barrier to trade. If you, it's called an offset. I'm sure I've lost everybody right away. An offset says that, okay, if I've got, I'm making a bid on a contract and I come in at $2.2 million and my competitor comes in at $2 million, but I have some kind of offsetting thing that I'm offering. I'm going to hire locals, I'm going to go green, I'm going to do something that actually benefits the community that has another objective, then, you know, that's sort of offsetting your costs, right, your higher costs. Offsets will become illegal under this. You have to take the lowest bidder. You have to go with whoever is coming in. And sometimes they have looked, and there's specific cases in Europe about this, where they have looked at things like conditions of environmental purchasing, and they said, no, this is a disguised barrier to trade. Is that clear? You have to really hunker down and look at the language and how they do it specifically, because otherwise, again, it just sounds like rhetoric. But this is how it works in practice. And there are all kinds of cases where this has been done under free trade regimes. So, purchasing is a big thing because governments purchase a lot of stuff, and governments and their entities includes the whole thing. It includes the federal government, provincial government, the local government, your school board, your universities, anybody who works in a governmental delegated kind of role. So that's a huge part of your economy. And governments traditionally have tried to swing things. Why not? Why wouldn't you build in something other than money into a contract? Well, they say that that goes against the market, and you got to get rid of that. Okay. So you're just basically stripping down everything into that kind of logic. The other big thing, now when Canada did a good thing today, it's hard for me to say this, but Canada did a good thing coming out against including investment in this agreement, but the other stuff that they're doing, it's as if they didn't think we'd notice. They put out their position. They did not put out their position on services. One of the main demands of this campaign, of the FTA campaign, is release the documents. We still have that demand because services is education, services is health, services is two-thirds of your economy. So if you release your position and you do not release services, you have not released your position. So come on, guys. You know, we weren't fooled by this. Let's come clean and really come out with Canada's position, because what we're interested in the other things, and we can read between the lines, but you come out with your services position so we know if you're trading off health and education. And we can talk in the break about, in the discussion period, about the specifics of how the things in an agreement privatize education, privatize health. And just to wrap up here, I'm collecting plastic handcuffs. I was down in Seattle, and I got some plastic handcuffs there. I was just down in Cincinnati. Have people heard about the big thing that happened in Cincinnati? No. And why would that be? Why would that be? That would be because our media is terrible and you don't get to hear the tremendous resistance that's going on to globalization worldwide. Cincinnati was picked for a big meeting just recently because it's known as a Republican town and nothing would happen. So they got there and people hit the streets and it was wonderful. It was just great. There's a citizens' movement of 100,000 members in Ohio. So they can run, but they cannot hide these people. There was an absolutely overwhelming police presence, so I brought back some plastic handcuffs from there. They had way more plastic handcuffs than they could have ever arrested people with. It was just total overkill. So I've got those as some of the images of what it is to be involved in the fight back against this form of corporate globalization. But I also, you're not going to be able to see this, but I also brought back a front page of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And that, you'll just have to come up. It's a wonderful photo. And it's of a woman in dreadlocks. And she's got her banner, and she's gone up to... Now, these police were three deep, okay? It was just unbelievably overwhelming. And they're all whispering about, which arrest unit are you? You know, which was a little unnerving. But she's just gone right up to them, and she's showing them her banner, which is People Before Profit. So that's another image of anti-corporate globalization.
That was Ellen Gould of the International Forum on Globalization.